I was just getting ready to go.
They don't have your office come calling in. Kind of freaks me out.
I think Marty was trying to do that as always.
There he is.
There he is.
Thanks.
Now we can start.
Well, we're about ready to go, and we're going to start on introductions anyway. So, Marty, why don't you start with an introduction?
Yeah, I wanted to introduce our newest county counselor. Many of you know Jeannie Stewart from her work at the City of Vancouver as a planning commissioner and as a council member. So this is our development and engineering advisory board. They'll introduce themselves. We have representatives from the Building Industry Association. So there's a good cross-section of the development community, the engineering community, the planning, legal community. So they kind of see the nuts and bolts of how our plans and our policies and our codes affect development. So they've been a group since about 2007, six. Yeah, so they bring a different perspective to some of the things that the county wants different boards and commissions. So I just wanted to introduce them to you. And
is one of their roles to identify codes or what they deem as unnecessary restriction, unnecessary whatever, that stands in the way of what they're all trying to do? They let us know about that and we see what we can do.
Yes.
Good.
We've run through, since they've been with us, we've run through many, many code amendments. And especially the ones that are really the nuts and bolts of how codes play out on the ground and in the development world. So whether it's grading permits or small lot development or you name it, they're going to be reviewing the code amendments on the proposed code amendments on a residential zones, what we allow in multifamily, the home business code. So they will give you their input.
It's wonderful. I appreciate that such a board exists. I heard about this for the first time. Well, I heard about it through BIA, and I've heard about it through some other folks that I recognize here that by its acronym. So it's good work. It's mutually beneficial. We don't want to be doing anything that unnecessarily interrupts progress. So thank you all for serving on the board and for your good work. This is one of the most highly respected boards. So
and I appreciate it.
Don't get them started.
There you go.
We appreciate that you're here, and you're always welcome.
I'll rub them up a little bit. But just to have them introduced so you can
appreciate that.
Yeah, let's just go and be the board first if you want. Go ahead, Don.
Don Hardy of Perjury Abound.
Steve Bacon with Clark Region of Wastewater.
Gaither Holmes.
Hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
You know me. So I'm here as the Building Industry Association representative, and I used to serve as an at-large position before that. I've been on since 2009.
Mike Overin, Olson Engineering.
Eric Galimo, SGA Engineering.
Jeff Ruston, Hospital.
No, I'm Andrew Gunther with PLS Engineering.
Alice Safoye, County Public Works Development Engineering.
Rosie Shell, Developer Engineering.
Matt Herman, Kevin Tyler, Environmental Services.
Devin Jackson, Lucas Engineering.
Wow, we've got a large public member.
You want to hang out?
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Hang out and watch the.
they booked my meetings about 10 minutes apart. So I have two things coming up, but I did pull a copy of the agenda, so I'll know roughly when you meet. And sometimes I'd really enjoy interrupting or bothering, but just to hear what's going on. So
exciting.
I think it would be. It can get excited.
Okay. Let's be more than
that.
I like to be here
in
person.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you,
James.
Appreciate it.
Have a good day.
Thank
you. So, yeah, we've been through introductions. Really quick, couple brief notes. Besides to turn off your cell phones if you have them with you. Also a reminder that we're being recorded and people like Jeannie can hear what you say today. So that's just for good of the order. Next measures, review and adopt the minutes.
I've reviewed them and I move to adopt. Second.
All right, we have the motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, I guess we're ready to vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Next is to review upcoming events.
Yes, I'm sitting in for Greg Schaefer today. He's out of town. Next DEEP meeting is on Thursday, March 5th at 2:30. The county manager briefing occurs on Wednesdays at 10 a.m. The Board of County Councillors hearing, there is a concomitant rezone agreement, CPZ 214-00010, Northeast 113th Street, Thursday, February 24th at 10 a.m. I'm sorry. This one says Thursday, but it's a Tuesday. Sorry. Yeah. So thanks for the correction. And I have a few other events that is not, for some reason, didn't get on the agenda. Tuesday, February 10th, it's the Board of County Councillors hearing at the Board Hearing Room at 10 a.m. CTRAN Board of Directors meeting at Vancouver Community Library, Columbia Room, 901 C Street, Vancouver at 5:30 p.m.
Which day?
February 10th, it's a Tuesday, at 5:30 p.m.
What's the hearing on top?
CTRAN Board of Directors meeting.
Oh, okay.
At the Vancouver Community Library. On Wednesday, February 11, there is a county manager briefing with the board at board training room at 10 a.m. At 1:30 p.m., the board has an executive session to discuss pending litigation with legal counsel and the board. At 2:30, conference room B. They have two dates in here, 1:30 and 2:30. I guess it's all executive session. Yeah, at 2:30, it's the board time. Was that clear, or should I repeat? So it's 1:30 executive session, at 2:30 board time. And I believe they are not open to public. Thank you, that's all we have. In February, you are up. You bet.
All right. Another reminder, we've got some expiring terms on the DEEP coming up here relatively quickly. The applications for those vacancies are due the 17th. So that's just a couple weeks out, or a little bit less than a couple weeks out. Yeah, it looks like those expire the end of March. Those include Mike, myself, Steve, Don, and Jamie. If you're planning to, interested in carrying on, want to get those applications into Jennifer Clark with the board. Any announcements? Members,
other than Terry,
we are ready to get into the main meat of the meeting here. First item is a TIF status update from Matt Herman.
So again, my name is Matt Herman. I'm the project manager for the TIF program update. The last time I talked to you was in December. And I presented the timeline that looks like this. Probably don't have it with you. But my information today is to present an update on our status, where we're at with this program update, and then to give you feedback. As you may have remembered, in December we were in the middle of forming our stakeholder advisory committee. That has been formed, consists of 8 folks, and they have been helping us throughout the process with feedback and present the project interest. We have supplied 2 memos that are in your packet. They are this page. This is the existing TIF and policy memorandum. It's basically the existing conditions of the TIF program and what it exists like today. The next memo is a best practices memo. This is a collection of systems used throughout the Northwest, and basically informs us as innovative situations that are going on throughout the Northwest to see if they're applicable to. These memos have been vetted through both our technical advisory committee as well as our stakeholder advisory committee. We are beginning the process of looking at proposed boundary revisions for the TIF districts. Those will be shared with our 2 advisory groups in the middle of that so that we can get both feedback to revise those districts or if you don't have anything to do. We're still on schedule. Again, this is a tight timeline. We're hoping for adoption by the end of July. And this is the tight timeline. Again, is because we currently have an interlocal agreement with the City of Vancouver where we share TIF districts. So because they have completed their process and have approved a new TIF program, we need to update ours rather quickly. The memos before you, they're quite lengthy, so I assume that you haven't had adequate time to look through those, but if you do have any feedback or want any questions regarding those, I'm always available.
As far as the TIF district boundaries, do you guys have any initial sense of changes? Or?
So the way that the boundaries work is the idea is to provide a nexus and proportionality to assessing the TIF fees within each district. So you begin with the spectrum of what do few boundaries look like and what do a good amount of boundaries look like and find that optimal range. So currently we're going through that process. We're waiting for the consultant, which is DKS, to come out with their findings on those. The 3 different things that they're proposing right now are both one with 3 districts, that's a rural district, 1 rural district. Right now we have 2 districts, and an urban district. The second one is with a current boundaries as they exist today, except for without the City of Vancouver shared boundaries. And then the third is a hybrid approach where we have 5 districts.
Matt, yes. May I ask a question? On the item number 2B, towards the last paragraph, it says, in recent years, many jurisdictions have looked at alternative methods to determine if it's a better fit urban setting.
Yes.
How does Clark County fit into that?
Right.
You're addressing.
And that's one of the issues, because we have two different standards going on. We have our rural section and our urban section. The split of projects between a regional project and a local project is really where that urban center comes into play. As I don't want to get into too much details, but the trip capture from an urban district is much different than the rural. So,
yes. So you're addressing Clark County's more rural set.
Rural and urban. I mean, urban meaning within the UGA's.
Oh, I see.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but
I'm sorry,
is
maybe that.
UGA.
Right. So outside of the urban limits, but inside of the UGA's.
Got it.
In the urban communities. So that would be the UGA's of Camas, Vancouver, and I believe a little bit of Washington.
Thank you for the clarification.
And just a question on the traffic impact fee district on page 3 of 7. The two that kind of stand out that have fairly significant increases, North Orchards and Mount Vista, on the rate per trip.
Where are you at?
At page 3 of 7, first. Is that because both those districts, I'm guessing they have a large number of road projects that are necessary? Those seem pretty substantial. Like Mount Vista, isn't that probably about 340 per trip?
No, these, the rates are from the 2014. I believe this went into effect November 4th.
Okay.
And all of the districts were lowered due to the changes in our concurrency program, which I believe you guys reviewed. It lowered the threshold for congestion. Therefore, the capital facilities plan was affected, and therefore the district rates went down.
These are higher than what, I mean, it's been a few years, but I'm just thinking about that Salmon Creek area. I don't recall them being,
they were 613.
They
were 700.
Yeah.
Oh, they were. Okay, so I'm a little behind the curve on that. So
on the next page, there's some rates. Is that the difference?
Oh, yeah, on page 6.
Yeah, I guess that's 2 pages down, yeah.
Okay.
Page 6 and 7.
Yeah.
There's some rates there.
Okay.
13.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, I guess I had not done a project in that area in a while. Just in front of those.
So they went down from 13 to 14.
Yeah.
But then they went up significantly from the previous one to 13. Because there were some old ones that were locked in. The county was doing a moratorium on raising the TIF fees for years, or for a while. And I think that just ended. And then the new fees kicked in. And we were just heard about that recently. Marty was involved in that as well. I heard about it.
Okay, so we're
half related to this, not really.
Is it somewhat related to this?
The fees have gone down from 13 to 14. What happened before 13?
So one of the options you guys are being considered then is just a straight urban and straight rural.
Yeah, that's one.
So not looking at different areas that maybe need more attention.
That's one option. There are different options. The idea basically behind our approach is it's a comparative analysis as far as how many districts. So you want to capture everything. You want to capture a range that's small and a range that's big to see if we can find an option.
Matt, last time you were here, I think the one thing that we were concerned about was getting people that have TIF credits involved earlier on in the process than at the end. Have you done any outreach to them at all?
There are some interviews happening tomorrow with our consultant and some critical consultant to address their particulars. And those are one-on-ones without the county staff there, so they can talk about their
importance. How are those particular stakeholders being selected?
Based on our credit holder that we manage.
Based on the ones that are most invested, maybe
most
credits or bucks.
Well, those that have a great amount of credits available to them, and those have been identified. There's a big range. There's a range of those that have more than 100,000 in TIF credits, and then there's quite a bit that have less than 10,000. So the ones that have been selected are both comprised of multiple.
Across the spectrum.
So thematically, though, I mean, the idea is that credits would continue. I'm guessing that's the theme.
The city of Vancouver has gone with the latecomers agreement process. We have ordered from our consultant a memo with the pros and cons of a credit system versus the pros and cons of a latecomers agreement process, so that we can go through the conversation as to the what the effects are. We want to weigh all parts. I think I can update you in the future as far as where we're going.
So, Matt, what would be the concerns of a party who currently owns TIF credits?
If they wish to redeem those credits, there's a couple different options. And these are just options. So there's the option to sunset them. That's not what we're looking for, because that's going to be unfair to the person that holds those credits. There's an option to transfer those to the new districts. And then there's an option to keep those basically multiple maps on the books. The maps that where the credits were redeemed, we keep those in there until they are exhausted.
Could be a long time. That's the old system, so to speak.
So if someone theoretically came in with three large buildings that were about $500,000 each, and they had $1 million in credit, they would be able to go up to their credit limit with those buildings.
Depending on, so in the past we've had both Orchards and North-South Orchards. Depending on when those credits were issued, if those were issued when we had just one Orchards, then that boundary when they want to redeem. If it was redeemed in South Orchards, then those boundaries. So it's kind of an administrative issue, but I think an issue of fairness.
But Mount Vista has not changed, is that correct? The boundary?
Boundaries have not, the rates changed, but the boundaries have not changed. This program update is exploring the boundary.
And Matt, the county's proceeding in absent the any effects of the current fee waiver.
Yes.
In other words, you're proposing a countywide, project-wide policy.
Correct.
Whether there is a fee waiver in place on aspects of the
cost. Absolutely. That's our assumption. Is the fee waiver program is. The way that the resolution was signed was it was a temporary. So this program update is meant to be standard. We still collect TIFs for residential.
This work started in concept before the fee waiver program was even around.
Yes. Great. Thanks.
But as a follow-up on that, though, is that going to get revisited, that whole the waiver system as part of this process, that this whole employment
decision? That's an important question.
So you guys treat it, I mean, if commercial development comes in, you're still treating the system as if you're getting it.
Right, but these are still assessed.
Theoretically,
they are not
moving back from some other department.
Right. So theoretically, it should be maybe coming out of general fund and be replaced by the tax.
Say they're absorbed by the road traffic and tax. Other fees are absorbed by the general fund.
Okay. But yes, I think that was the theory.
In December, you invited me back to speak today. You want me to come back in another
day? I think it'd be good to continue to get updates. What's your overall schedule on this?
So, yeah, we are scheduled to come to you in June with our final product for recommendation. So the next update I could give you, which you would see, substantial final product would be
that's what I was thinking. I think that gives us a little bit of time to hopefully react and have comments or concerns and thoughts.
Yeah, we'd be certainly interested in what the what you're finding from the show group and the technical advisory group, as well as the input from the
I think people will be a great time to get an update.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I still owe Marty a copy of the ordinance. I've been waiting to see what the state legislation is going to look like this year, and how I was able to get a copy of it.
House Bill 1709.
So it limits the number of building permits that would be applicable on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis. You know, again, my take on that would be, let's not try to do that here in the county. Didn't want to get a sense of where the going on the building for me to be able to bring back the
country. We're staying on schedule. Nothing done today at work, so.
Should be
a hassle.
This is fun.
All right, so we'll throw you back on next month.
Thank you.
All right.
Did you touch a little bit on what the bill says, though? I have it up. And it talks about recording a covenant that is essentially a lien, and once the payment is made at closing, through some predetermined point under a county ordinance, or 18-plus months after the building permit was issued, is when you would remove the lien and the covenant once it was financially satisfied. The 20 kind of reads a little funky because it talks about an applicant receiving. So if you're a smaller builder, you could get as many, and you only build 20 a year, you could get all of them deferred.
There's a policy reason behind that, because the governor, when he vetoed it, accused builders of really at being advantageous for the NRs.
Oh, the big builders, the big national builders.
Yeah, the Centexes of the world, which is nonsense. But so that's the reason why that's in there, is to overcome his least concerns.
But the people sponsoring it, it's
moderate.
It's moderate, conservative, and liberal, and
it passed
more the conservative Senate, and more liberal.
The very yes. Senate 47-2 last time.
On the House side,
it's 96-4. So you can tell that it's going to pass. Mm.
And so when it passes, then you're the county going to have to adopt it.
And if the governor signs it, then yes, this would be a statewide thing for every jurisdiction would be mandated to have it. Until.
Well, that makes sense. Okay. So, but it's voluntary, right?
No, mandatory.
No. Meaning, you don't have to have it in place.
No.
Could volunteer to have it placed.
Yes.
And defer the payment.
Yes. You always have the opportunity to voluntarily pay.
Okay.
Yeah, it says that the county, cities, and towns collecting impact fees must adopt a permanent system for collection of so on and so forth. So it's mandatory.
Guess we'll find out.
You have to remember, legislation always gets amended too.
All right. Well, thank you, Jamie. I guess we'll chat more on that again next month.
Or not.
Or it might be another short. We'll reserve 10 minutes. It's going to be 10 minutes ahead. The next item is, let's see, Oliver here. Is somebody taking.
Oh. Jose is.
Okay, I figured. Probably.
So.
All right, so the next item is an update on the comp plan status. Sounds like Jose is going to help us out.
Okay, so on January 28th, we had a work session with the board where they decided that they wanted to consider a fourth alternative for our EIS process, which we hadn't considered up to that point. We're working with the board's office on coming up with a fourth alternative, and we scheduled a work session for February 18th to bring something forward. We were anticipating having something from our environmental consultant, but as a whole, we'll be figuring out if we're going to have a fourth alternative and what the implications of that are going to be going forward.
Can you back us up, Shep? Alternative.
We have to study, we're doing a supplemental environmental impact statement. We're using what was done in 2007. Right. And so, because it was such a large area that we considered at that time, we thought that had enough breadth to consider that. The fourth alternative, it appeared to deal mostly with a lot of rural resource land issues, which weren't considered primarily in 07, so it's still unclear what that means for the environmental analysis and whether it's going to be a full-blown EIS or whether we can continue using the supplemental.
Is that a work session on February 18th?
Yes.
At 10 a.m.?
Probably 18.
Is this the fourth alternative where is there to talk about taking some of the rural lands and rezoning them, bringing the zoning down, or taking some ag and making it rural or residential, or
one of the things that we're looking at that brought forward to us is looking at parcelization. So parcels that are less than 10 acres that are in ag forests zones, and either bring them out of the resource designation and putting them into an R5 designation.
Right. So this is what, it's kind of what Clark County Citizens United has been requesting.
Okay.
Curious about
that. So this board kind of had two outstanding issues. One was the growth rate, and then the other was the infrastructure percent reduction. Where are those at?
No change.
Okay.
Also, as an update, you want to be on the original
submission?
Yes.
We did get a request from Richfield. Jamie can talk about that.
I can talk about that for hours. we did.
Tuesday, not Tuesday.
Yeah.
What's that? The Ridgefield?
Yeah.
Was it 102 acres?
106
acres. 106 acres, north of Ridgefield. Currently designated as ag. Proposed to be bring in for housing.
So what was the injunction?
That's
no, it's
north of 45th.
Yeah, for west.
Gotcha.
Just south of the casino, right? Yeah,
north of the roundabout.
Yeah, south of the casino.
Proposed casino.
So do any of the alternatives have any expansion?
Yes.
The center is proposing some expansion. Battlegrounds to the west.
Ridgefield.
Ridgefield. And I think we've got another submittal for the center to include a property that's 17 acres for a school site.
So not much, though, any of the alternatives?
Since we haven't had as much growth and since we've expanded the boundaries, we just haven't used up all of the capacity that's
on the population side. I would concur with Jose that thus far this board has not decided to revisit it, but it did come up in the hearing.
Yeah,
some other public testimonies.
Councilor Stewart brought up the issue of some legal planning assumptions. Whether there was an opportunity to visit those.
I thought it was pretty well addressed in the town of Elton, a pretty big can of work. So,
your sense is not a lot.
I don't think that will be revisited. I think the sense that complications that might be that there's so many other things that are based on those existing assumptions. So I know it came up in public testimony, but I don't think that's going to my impression.
Soldiered on with that conversation a few times. That back up. We're having schedule. All right, Neil. Okay, thank you, Jose. Cruising right along, I guess the next item is the code amendment related to home occupied business and the MF zone. Marty.
So I know that Jan has distributed, yes.
Yes.
A memo on the single family detached units and medium potential residential zones, where this memo kind of outlines how much land there is and the various uses. When we look at those R12 to 1822, it's about 8% of the residential zoning, so there's not a lot. Even less than the R30, R43. There are some comp plan policies that speak to a diversity of housing types, a diversity and mix of housing types. And I remember this battle between 1999 and 2004 where minimum densities were set in the Vancouver and in the kind of the larger of the of the cities, and then the center goes up to 4 units per acre. So the code amendment moving, at least the proposed code amendment moving forward, was to look at prohibiting single family detached on these R12, 18, 22, 30, and 43. Own properties. I know that Eric has expressed interest in maintaining the single family detached AR 12-18-22, and he has some examples. The idea to keep the code the way it is, Eric and I had a conversation earlier, is, you know, the market should dictate which product type this is. Or, you know, is it true multifamily? Is it single family detached, or is it single family attached? So, you know, these are your arguments to make. The Planning Commission is interested in your feedback. The board will be interested in your feedback. So that's on the single family. On the proposed amendments to the home business ordinance, Peter, I've asked him to kind of be here for any questions. He's had more interaction with the board on this proposed amendment. Suffice to say, the board, you know, has been interested in opportunities for job creation, job growth. It's not exclusively in the urban area; it's into the rural centers and the rural areas. So, their hope is that by amending the code and removing a limitation, that'll provide some opportunities there. Other than that, I've not had the interaction with the board. So the Planning Commission will take both of these things up in March. They'll be wanting to hear from Eve, and then, of course, the board will be wanting to hear from you and the Planning Commission. So, Jen, do you have anything else to add other than this is information?
Not really.
So that's where we're at. And again, I'm thankful that Peter is here and he'll be available in the Planning Commission meetings we have.
Jan, on you put this together.
Was
this chart that bases the percentage of area for each different zone on acreage done to show how there could potentially be a disconnect between the policy 2.7.1 says that there shall be no more than 75% in single product type of housing in any jurisdiction. Okay, so you base that purely on acreage of zone 5.
Not units
that could be developed minus critical areas, minus infrastructure, minus anything like that.
No, it's just based on acreage.
I think it's a pretty simplified approach.
Oh, yeah. And it gets really skewed by the rural area.
There's no rural area.
All in the urban area.
Yeah.
WHD decided to
Right.
Then what type of
family? We have multi-family.
Right. Okay.
There's no multi-family in the rural area.
Okay. Yeah. Not in the rural.
Well, there's no high density.
Right.
Residential zone.
So this is Vancouver, UGA.
Rural.
Yeah,
that's correct. Right.
Yeah, and that's where it would apply. But, and we can get the more detailed numbers of the dwelling units, but you're going to have to be pretty hitting high on those multifamily densities to make up for the difference in the amount of acreage.
Because if you take it based on an acreage, the next step would be then to, okay, if you just took it on gross acreage, then you'd have to figure out the density and the number of units for that gross acreage.
Right. And the other thing we can look at is so it's built. And we can just, these are parcels.
Yeah.
And so we can look at the parcels don't, if they're developed, won't include any of those critical lands.
Right.
So you, we can do it and give you the numbers for that. And there's a lot of teasing out the data for both zones. It's a little complicated because the amount of development that's already existing. So you have in the R110 zone, or even in the R12, got a lot of property that was developed prior to, so they're 10,000 square foot lots, And so trying to get at the density could be a little tricky.
And I think that, and I understand that, but if we were to take a look at this from a undeveloped standpoint now, your acreage is kind of your first step.
Yep.
Then let's say that you have the same amount of critical areas in the high density zones versus, as well as the low density. So we'll just make that a concept. Okay. Then you take the density ranges, multiply that out to see what the unit count is for each one, and I can guarantee that any 5 feet is going to probably change higher on the higher density and lower on lower density.
Right. But it's going to be, you know, really pushing the limit just to make it work mathematically.
So how
to get
then,
25 from that low of a base is going to be very difficult.
So how then is the policy, how is that 75% measured? Is it by built? Or is it by, could be
built.
Built.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little, it's a little skewed because we put multifamily on our units per the acre.
It's not skewed.
Yeah, you have the high density.
But yeah, so there's no question. And we can look at the data, or you can make an assumption about what you're going to get in those density ranges.
Yeah.
R30, R43.
It's going to be hard.
Typically, come down on the lower end. In the urban medium, you're probably in the middle. You'll get a high amount in the R12. Once you get up to R22, you're starting to fall off a little. And it depends on whether you do it single family detached, you include single family detached, mm-hmm. We can break it out that way too and see what density we're getting.
Is there anything I complain about providing for affordable housing?
Yes.
So one of the challenges that I see with this here is that there is, you look at the single family detached zones and the smallest lot size, if you take this out, the smallest lot size you can have for single family detached house is 5,000 square feet. This is an extremely popular and important product in Kern County. This provides entry level housing. It's for our kids to get into their first home. This is a product that probably starts at about, you know, 220 to 250,000. When you have a 5,000 square foot lot, the average selling price is 5,300,000. We're pricing out first time home buyers, we're pricing out affordable housing. We're affecting our kids who have got their first home that are going to have. So what you're doing is say you can't build this, but here's, and this is two examples that are right next to you.
Right.
This is an R18.
Right.
You can't build this in R, this does not fit in our R15.
Right.
It doesn't. I mean, it's not affordable. And it would be, you from this product type to about 300,000 with the current price of lots. With the comp plan with a low growth rate, it's going to mean this land's less available. So it really affects affordable housing. And I really think it's a step backwards, and I'm curious, because what I've heard is we don't want to build tomorrow's slums today. And there's a few other apples that I think kind of drove to disallowing this. And this is a picture, I don't think of a bad apple, this is a typical. There's a lot of this stuff that goes on in Clark County. This is what we're pretty much forcing. You're taking the same product and you're attaching it. But because the comp sales and what you can get for a detached versus attached, it's probably close to $20,000 to $30,000 difference in resale. And they don't appreciate it. So what you get is, they're not willing to put nice finishes in. They can't, the market won't dictate it. So we're forcing, and we're gonna take the same land, and if you're concerned about building tomorrow's slums today, this is the opposite impact. It's gonna have more detrimental things than it does help the market. And we're really affecting affordable housing.
Right.
And then we're stopping flexibility and
yeah, and I don't know how many problems with the affordability issue. I guess my take would be, shouldn't we look at expanding the urban low to include these smaller lots? That's where the bulk of the land is.
So maybe you change R18 or R12 to 18. And
you don't have, you have a very low base to start with. Why do you want to do that? You have a very low base to start with there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people.
There's a high demand for this type of housing.
Absolutely. Yes, I don't have any problems with that. I'm just saying that you've got R110, R17, you have a much bigger base to start with, where you can expand that to include those types of lots. That's all I'm saying.
This question was interrupt your train of thought.
Yeah.
Just from a data standpoint, why would you not calculate the units?
I could. I just want to keep it simple.
I can do that. We can
just a quick map based on
what's
I can
my,
the industry standards that I'm as far as development, R15, R20, R12, R22, et cetera. I get about 90,000 housing units in the first category, and I get about 28,000 housing units in the second category. It really changes the ratios.
Right. Yeah, no, I understand.
You should just include that in your decision making process.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that.
Would
you just use an estimate of what you see in, like, in the.
Well, you're using acreage.
No, I understand that. I'm fine with your suggestion. I just want to clarify that. So, because I did the same calculation in the urban loans, you'd expect to see about six overall.
And
that's it. No, I understand. How do you have 90,000?
Did you do it right? I did an average, industry average of the number of lots that we put into a typical R16 per acre.
I can do the calculations for each one, and so you can see what it would take in order to get to the same. That's not a problem.
I think it would help, because I don't know, per se. I just know what I see as far as industry development. Typical industry development is, but I don't know where that would lead you as far as decision options.
This, bear in mind that when we asked Jose to do this, we wanted him to keep it just at this level, and if he wants that to present it in that manner, if you want us to further refine it, there's so many other ways that we can find that, but this was just to give you an idea on a higher level type of analysis. We are not making any decisions.
Help this was again. Yeah, and I wouldn't expect that the ratio to come out to be what the acreage is because of the difference in density.
Right.
And it's going to be much higher in the
early. Other thing, on the first page, you said, given the attached data, it appears that.
Yes.
It's
leading. There's a lot of units here.
Based on the attached data,
yes.
If you're relying entirely on the data, I suppose.
If you're relying on the data, though, this data is not in front of zoning. If you're relying on this data, you're saying that you've already zoned 85% of it single-family detached,
right. Which
means you're outside of compliance with the policy just based on the way you zoned the property.
Right.
So. Why would you look at rezoning some of the property rather than changing what's allowed in the zoning? Why wouldn't you just look at rezoning some of the property into higher densities to get?
That was my suggestion.
That's the problem. There's a gap. There's a huge gap in your code now. You don't allow that in the zones that were originally intended. So one thing that when this started, it was talking about removing single-family detached from multifamily zones. And I want to clarify, R18, R12, they are not multifamily zones. Even in the code, it is medium and high density. They're grouped. I agree. The comp plan, you should not build single-family detached in high density.
Right.
But medium density is intended for entry-level housing, and it was always intended for that. It's always been in there. When the comp plan was in here, it allowed this type of
project. It's actually a conflict with the comp plan. Because in the comp plan, it specifically says under urban medium, it doesn't include single-family detached.
Where is that in here?
It's in the comp plan.
Any differences in the section you gave us? That would be important.
Yeah, I mean, just taking this up a notch, kind of like, let's get rid of the mathematical stuff for a second. I think fundamentally, does it really make sense to regulate the square footage issue if the density can be met? I mean, that's kind of fundamentally the issue. I mean, if you can meet the density with single-family smaller lots, who cares? I mean, that's kind of, I agree with Eric on the product issue. It's really difficult when the product is being mandated as being attached. If you can meet the density, and the code currently allows it by reviewing the Google website, how do you treat a mobile home park? Are you going to deny that? How is that different than smaller lots? I mean, it could be a mobile home subdivision or a mobile home park. I mean, it just seems like a very narrow kind of perspective on this issue about lot sizes. where I think affordability is huge. Other communities have used reasonable measures in their comprehensive plan amendment process and going through and looking at mix of uses and housing types. We have smaller lots and larger subdivision areas where you've got a mix of range of uses. I don't understand forcing the attached issue. I'm not getting that.
And I think it's just a policy call from the, I mean, we started in 94 with, what was it, 60% single family and 40% multifamily? That was the goal. And then in 2004, because we weren't even close to that, we went to 75-25.
But you could call it multifamily. I mean, it's single family because of its product, but its nature, the density, it's multifamily.
It's the diversity of housing type.
What difference does it make? I'm not getting it.
Right, but why wouldn't you just put it in your other subdivision for results? Because you can't. I mean, I know that apartment building isn't popular, but some people need that.
No, I think you're still meeting the density requirements.
I'm not talking about the density requirements. I'm talking about land that's available before that. Because if you run out of land, then it's going to drive up the cost for anyone to want to build that.
I'm going to search my memory banks and see if Marty will be.
Well, there are memory banks back here, too.
Open up the box. 60-40, 75-25, it's all in the database.
What is prompting this? So what is the issue that we're trying to address? What's the problem?
Yeah, we didn't
what
get that
something? Yeah, maybe Peter knows, I don't know.
Really? This issue I don't know. And I'll be
right back. It's a commissioner issue, or council member issue.
That's right.
Right,
yeah,
they didn't like some
starting from any place else.
Yeah, they didn't like the product.
Here's all that I would ask. Thank you for this data. If you just take it to the next step, at least for me,
we're
going to need you.
That's where
we'll have to sit that down.
Jamie wanted to say something.
I do want to say the history of this.
Jamie, was all your fault.
It was all my I believe it was Marty's city's fault that he was there at Canada.
Well, Ben Stewart was picking on us.
And the county. But no, in all seriousness, goal 2.7 with this product split was really to address some what was at the time perceived inequities amongst the city and the perception, at least, that Camas was not accepting and Jeff remembers this on the Planning Commission, not accepting its due percentage of multifamily residents and not accepting its due density. And so they tried to force Camas through this policy to adopt, make them do more dense product and get more of a split between multifamily and single family within their own comp plan. And I think it's had that impact there. We've seen multiple family product having gone there. So I don't want to kid ourselves, but that's sort of what the intent of that was. This concept of percentages as to what is and what isn't, I don't know whether it's germane to the discussion present day.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And it was the argument that the smaller cities weren't taking
their fair share.
And it was all single family, large lot development. So when the policy changes said, well, here are a variety of different housing types, I think a current discussion would be that a small lot, single family detached, for purposes of density is where we want to go. Not to absolutely force a certain product type down a jurisdiction's throat.
It kind of gets to what is the objective. Is the objective is affordability. It's arguably, you can argue both sides of that. I mean, is it purely mathematical? And I get the 25% part, but it feels like it's kind of a density issue because affordability can be argued both ways.
Or is it an aesthetics issue?
That's what we were trying to ask about where this is coming from. And I also want to know why it's being, I should say it on the planning commission about it all the time, why it's being shoved down our throat so quickly, such a huge change. I mean, I wonder why are we looking at this during the during the comp plan update? Because we're opening up a whole can of worms on these percentages and things like that, which had reasons why the policies were adopted. That you're exactly right, that a lot of it was going back to Canvas and some of their mix of product. I mean, it opened up a whole can of worms, and what worries me, I mean, I don't even know how to address it to give a recommendation. I know where I fall on it. I mean, I adamantly just absolutely disagree with it. I think this tomorrow slum today, I think I know where it came from, but you have a tendency more, like Eric was saying, on the attached product, I think you have a tendency more to maybe have that concern. But I guess I'd like to see pictures of all these slums that we've built out there with these horrible detached housing. You're barring us to drop everything and adopt these massive code changes. It's just crap. It's wrong to do it this fast.
I think, like Eric said, there's maybe a couple of bad apples and people have that in their mind, but when a plat comes through and you see 2,600 square foot lots, that was the concern that was raised at the board's level, and they associated those two. And
there's a better way to skin the cat, and if it's the issue of having a really narrow product, you could address that with a lot of things. And right now there's a huge gap between the R15 and what is actually affordable housing. And we don't have an affordable housing anymore. We will not have an affordable single family housing for you. You're forcing everyone into apartments. And I don't know too many people.
No, and I take your point. R15 used to be that was the entry level lot that you could get into. If that's changed, then we should relook at that, through the comp plan, and look at expanding that.
I mean, I'll speak anecdotally. I had a nice lunch with Jeff last week, and he was sort of talking about the economics of development and what they're having to deliver. Even at this R16, R15 range, I kind of agree with Eric that the product price is already out of reach for the average income earner in Clark County, and that's because things are more expensive because of infrastructure and regulation. And so on and so forth. And so I think if we're pushing.
Do you have some data on the product type and the difference between those zones?
I mean, we could
gather. So that's part of what I'm saying about where I feel like this gets shoved down our throat, because it's a balance out there. And we do, I mean, obviously we can get data on product type, but to be able to do it in, we got this last month, and to be able to do it by and advised by March. I mean, again, I'm still trying to figure out what we're trying to resolve in terms of who brought it up, where's the, there's always a concern. What's the neighborhood that's a concern, or the neighborhoods, or whatever, I mean, so that we can figure out what it is we're trying to solve. But, I mean, I just think, the market kind of dictates all through those, all through all our zones, there's flexibilities and density. And you meet the density through all those zones. Sometimes you make a decision on 10,000 square foot lots to go smaller. Sometimes you go bigger. All the way down through all these zones, the single family detached and attached has been an issue. And right now, that to get something in that affordable, wherever that affordable is, when I say 225, 250, something like that, and have it detached, it's going to be on these smaller lots. Eric's exactly right. The 5,000, 6,000 square foot lots have gotten to a price point where builders can't put them on the ground for much less than, or they'll be tomorrow slums because they'll be completely stripped down product, potentially.
So it wasn't terribly long ago that we amended or developed a small lot. And we had the infill code. We had the infill code. The infill code was repealed.
Yeah.
And so we developed a small lot development standard.
Yeah.
That wasn't so long ago, so there was merit then
mm-hmm.
to address this issue. And
And that's more from the aesthetic side, too.
Right. That was for the aesthetic side.
And it wasn't too long ago that the attached housing was actually selling and desirable. That's the dynamic in the market has changed to where, I mean, a lot of the subdivisions that were built as attached housing subdivisions have now been replatted they started building single family in there because they couldn't sell the other product. So I mean, you're in your quest to increase densities and housing type, you in this market you would not have that effect because you just wouldn't get people building those types of things. People would go in for zone changes and try and get R15. or they wouldn't buy it because they're not going to buy the property if they can't sell the product. And there's even the ones that started out being built as townhouses, they've got five townhouses built, you know, or duplexes, triplexes, and now they're in there building single family because they can't sell the townhouse product.
And I think where the problem came from is when some of these are trying to be converted and they don't want to go through post-decision reviews, they just want to do it on the lot. And the code currently allows a 25-foot wide single-family detached lot. And in my practice, that is too small, but people are allowed to do it. So they're cramming things, and that would allow a 17-foot wide unit. That's too narrow, but people did. And because they didn't have a choice, there was too much process, those are the bad apples. And those are the ones that the county commissioners are looking at and saying, we don't want these. So now you're throwing out maybe with the bad water. You have 35-foot wide lots that are not going to be allowed. I'm going to keep on going with this. 35-foot wide lots. And now these aren't allowed either. But we have nowhere else to go that far from the county. And I think maybe it's sitting down with the commission and kind of explaining. Because I really do think their intentions are good. I think there's a real issue. And I hate to say that there's nothing that there's. We deal with this every day. That's why this board is here. We're here to advise the commissioners and to give them advice on before these things get adopted. And I think what you're hearing from us is we think there's some adverse impact, and I think we should reconsider it. And in my opinion, there's a better way to do it. I think you could change it really quickly. You make the minimum lot with 28 feet from 25. And I've done quite a few projects where you can fit a nice product on that, a nice affordable product. So.
Is there a way, just a question, I get what you guys are trying to do, to fit the 25%, 75%. Going back to what Marty said about the single lot and the small lot standard, is there a way to say reasonable use measure under parameters, under your comp plan process, this size of the lot is going to be considered multifamily? That's essentially the discussion point. I mean, that's, I think, part of what needs to be looked at.
That's a possibility.
It's kind of a win-win. I mean, that's... But again, what is that? What is that lot? I mean, what is that? What are those, the widths of that? But I think that's kind of where, I think for me, it's a density issue, but I understand it's a quantification issue for the county. You got to fit it within the policies, the broad policies. But if it fits that, if that small lot fits into a multifamily scheme and then fulfills that, it seems like a win-win.
And should be noted that the multifamily or the medium density building in comp plan doesn't prohibit the detached product.
No.
It allows for attached product.
Right.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that there's a conflict between the comp plan and the code on the urban medium, because the urban medium in the comp plan specifically says it is not allowed. It doesn't include it as one of the options in the urban medium.
No, we just read it. Did we miss something?
It says urban medium provides for land for single family attached housing, garden apartment, and multifamily developments ranging from 10 to 22. So it doesn't specifically disallow it.
In the urban low it says specifically single family detached.
But you can't have single family attached in the urban low.
That's
so it's correct.
Right. I think there's something, some of the good actions to this.
And in, you know, we're at Washington State, so we have a specific rules of general kind of framework where codes overrun comp.
Right. Yeah.
So whatever it says in our code.
That's why it's a policy call. That's why it's a policy call.
Yeah.
So we're here.
And if you have thoughts, ideas, concerns. This is being put on Marty's lap, so you have to provide those. And provide those comments. If we get a message to compliant policy changes, that's where we'll come in. But it is a good discussion. We weren't proposing any changes of this to the compliant. You know, it was directed to Marty to consider amending the code to disallow single family and all that kind of business. That's why we're bringing it to you. I'm not speaking for Marty, but that's where we are.
We could probably keep going a while on that.
Yeah.
Because of time, maybe we have a motion, and I would move to formally oppose the suggested code change.
Second.
And we can provide a memo, and I'll be happy to draft that and circulate it for approval for votes. So I'm agree with it.
Would you provide a THC explanation?
Yes. I'll put together a memo, and I'll put a signature on it myself, and then Andrew, not the new chair, and I'll circulate around for everyone to review and get a motion before we submit anything to any formal body.
I'd like just to add, you know, just on the conversational level, I think there's a seeking process here of what will work. So this small lot piece, I think that needs some help in some direction.
Right, but on the surface,
yeah,
I think that's what
I'm talking about. I agree. I'm just saying that I think there's two steps. One is, you know, this is not something that we're supporting, but there's a direction here on trying to go and create something that will work on that small lot basis.
The one thing that I had in my preliminary markup was suggesting instead the concern about those real narrow units to go with a wider minimum. Is that something this board can I get a quick test if you guys support that as an alternative?
I think we want to take a closer look at that because what we don't want to do is we don't want to do the opposite of what we're trying to do here on the other side.
Right.
Maybe there is the opportunity for townhomes to be built and at
that
25 foot width or the 22 foot width or whatever you're talking about here. And maybe we do look at, okay, well, if it's a detached product, then it's a minimum width.
That's exactly what I was saying.
And,
for only detached. I think that can address the concern that Commissioner Shad addresses the concern they have with not all the negative impacts.
You're asking for feedback.
Yes.
So yes, I'm supportive of your motion.
Okay.
Two, I think keep your explanation conceptual, and that there are alternatives and details that we would like to follow up with.
I think we follow up with that.
Yeah. Like, I'll circulate something.
Okay. Does anyone know where these troubled products are?
We've asked.
I'd like to see them because it may be something that
is an anomaly, or
it could be an anomaly, or it could be something that, yeah, exactly. It could be. So I'm not quite ready, and I agree to follow up if needed, because it's pretty complex. I'm not quite ready. I always worry about throwing out flexibility on someone's part and saying, you know, have to be this wide to kind of see.
Right, and that's why we want to
know. Yeah. Maybe there's a design stand. I don't know. I guess, you know, yeah.
We've done that, though. We did that with the small hours.
Yeah.
That's been done.
I'm going to call you.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess we've got a motion and we've sort of gone through more discussion already. I don't think we've landed on any amendments this time. So
would you restate the motion, please?
The motion is that we're essentially opposing the proposed language.
Yes, and we will compile a letter to the funding commission.
Okay.
In response.
Yeah. And so I guess we are ready to vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Abstentions?
Aye.
Yeah. I think that was a healthy conversation.
Now we've got 5 minutes for the home.
So we're halfway through.
Thank you.
As far as that.
Yeah, just want to thank you guys for working on this and for the future correspondence.
No, do have concerns about if we want to make sure we're here. So,
the difficult part is the anecdote here, I think, is staff is presenting a solution to a more of a policy problem. And it's hard to present that, I think. And so I look forward to working with staff as a member of the board and trying to solve the concern, address the concern. I think you all
we're going to talk about the
I'm almost afraid to say it.
Yeah.
Since we're not ready.
Technically, the whole business ordinance.
Oh, no. HBO.
Yeah.
HBO.
It's showtime on the HBO.
Peter, are you going to learn that conversation?
I can try to lead on this as well. I guess I can't fail since I do have some first hand knowledge from the Commissioner's office on this one. So, this issue did come to the Commissioner's office. I can't remember any specific constituent. I don't believe it's an ongoing issue, but the idea ended up getting batted around about is there a possibility of providing additional relief in the home business ordinance to people that want to run a business on a rural parcel. One in case just exceeded the requirements, and I think it was a 7.5-acre parcel, and they wanted to have 6 employees. They were considered buying the property. Our current limit is 4 employees on a 7.5-acre parcel. So the question was, can we grant some flexibility there up to numbers, or the proposal that eventually got forwarded to our planning department was if we consider or evaluate eliminating the employee number or restriction altogether. And the reason we came up with that is that there are other existing numbers or restrictions that would constrain the ultimate number of employees that you could have anyway. Just to give you an example, there's on a 5-acre lot, you can have a maximum allowable accessory structure use of 2,500 square feet. So how many employees can you fit in that type of square feet? Outside of the structure, the total activity area can only be 4,000 square feet. So how many employees or vehicles can you fit in that? So with that example, those kind of limit the ability to expand. So this wasn't intended to be the idea that they have an unlimited number of employees, but that it would be self-limiting based on the other constructions. So again, it was forward of planning to have it distributed to DEEB and the Planning Commission for their recommendation, whether that's a good idea or not.
Thank you.
What's the process then? So if you're going to go for a home business right now, what process? The type 1 process?
Type 2.
It's a type 2.
It's for major world, it's type 2.
Is there any designation between number of employees to go to a type 1 or 2?
There's an exempt home business, really very small. They don't have to get a permit at all. There's a minor home business, which we are not touching the standards for that. This change only applies to major.
Rural major, yeah.
That, like you said, is an RU type 3 process.
So, Pete, are these in the rural area only, or these are not in the urban area, then, right?
Well, there's a rural and urban home business, large major home business. We only originally proposed this for the rural. So considering if you want 5 to 7 acres.
Okay, so that's the threshold then. You can't do it in R110 on a 10,000 square foot lot.
No, that wasn't our intention to alter that at all.
That's significant.
So what the proposal is to get rid of the cap completely everywhere. That's what we've seen.
Sorry, when Kate left with the Commissioner's office, I thought it was only for the rural major home.
It's not. It's a complete elimination of the cap anywhere.
That's a big deal.
That's why we're talking about.
So again, if you want to consider that in that context, you can recommend no in urban and yes in the rural.
Let me just give you kind of my experience. I live on a dead end street. There's multiple people that have their own home businesses on that street. Not an issue whatsoever. Got a guy that's a contractor.
Urban or rural?
This is urban.
Okay.
Does his own construction, brickwork, He's a contractor. There's a person next to me that's a graphic artist. And up the street, suddenly he's taking care of kids. I think there's 2 daycares. People being dropped off and picked up. That's a lot different because those people basically aren't bringing in a whole bunch of rigs and you're not seeing a bunch of employees parking there. Mm-hmm. That changes the dynamic of a single-family residential life. That's a big change. I think if it's in context of, you know, you're not increasing parking, you know, and traffic issues, you know, where people are, you know, parking on your street and storing things, that changes the dynamic. So I, in the urban area, I think so. I mean, I think I'm all for home occupations. I think they're great, but I mean, that's kind of a big deal when, you know, you could theoretically have 20 people on your street parking on the street that wouldn't normally be there. That's not really a single family in the purpose of that.
And I don't think that would fall into a permitted activity right now under the ordinance, because you have to provide a parking space for an employee if you're in a business right now. You wouldn't be allowed to have employees park on the street.
Okay. So, right, but in reality, we've seen that, you know, there's parking on the street, there's parking down the street, there's parking over there, and, you know, the enforcement of that now becomes even greater if you have an unlimited number of employees that you can have. Suddenly, it's, oh, well, you know, I have my space for my employee or two employees here, yes, that's fine, and I'm all legal. Oh, wow, there's no cap, I'm going to hire four more people and park wherever you can. And then there's an enforcement issue. So now you're getting into more of a code enforcement situation where you've never had that issue before because you had a cap on the number of employees.
I mean, it's really, I mean, you know, I think it's about giving people opportunity to work out of their house. I forgot about the guy across the street that is woodworking. But again, not an issue. I mean, he does it at night, and like people come and they load up their trucks with like cabinets and stuff, whatever he's doing. And I mean, that's not it's infrequent. But I think the issue really is that if you're condoning, I mean, it's kind of like you're allowing a commercial activity in a residential zone. I mean, that really is kind of fundamentally it doesn't really belong there.
And how many employees are they allowed to have in a major home business?
Six. Well, it's 4 up to 10 acres, and then 6 over 10 to 20, or over 10.
I feel that there's some potential to open it up for abuse, where if you have an underdeveloped parcel in the urban area, zone residential, that might as well be zone commercial. It might as well, because when you look at going through this picture, you can meet the other negative impacts, but again, it's a possible compliance problem, because now that's not going to be single family. It's going to be commercial or even industrial. So it's not going to be the situation that an established neighborhood, because other things in the code protect against that, like number of parking stalls, size of the structure. But I mean, I have a client right now where they had a landscape business that's grown to be too big for what he was running out of his house, and he's buying a commercial parcel right now. So you think everybody's moving it there, and he's having to jump through a lot of hoops. But it, you know, it's every business has to do that when they build a new building, when they go to a different location. But if this was the case, he would just buy an underdeveloped parcel in an established neighborhood, and he would just run his landscape business out there because he could. He can meet all those other criteria. It's not necessarily like in the neighborhoods or even the rural, it's just underdeveloped parcels. It can be abused. So again, you know, personally, I'm very pro job growth, and I want to see the opportunities for businesses to grow, employment. It's just the potential adverse impacts and making sure that if we make a change, we don't create more headaches. And is there a better way to do something? And I think there are some criticisms right now with the number of points. You might be too restrictive, but take the number completely off.
The one home business that I know of that has exceeded these numbers was that the application came in, call it 2007-08, and was approved with some limitations, but their employment number was 15. And I think it was on 10 acres roughly. So, you know, if you take these numbers and say, well, we'll take them at 2.5x. So that upper limit would be 15 on 15 and or 10 acres and larger, and on under 10 acres it'd be you know 10 employees instead of 4. The idea of having a number down, from my perspective, would allay some possible challenges and appeals and concerns by neighbors who. I bought 5 acres to live my rural residential life, not to be surrounded by 2 and 3 other, you know, 5-acre parcels with 30, 40 employees.
I mean, it would open up the opportunity for those 10 and 15 employees.
I have a question. Did the Vermont people pay impact fees?
No.
In fact,
so they're creating trips out there.
Yes, right. These are not, Vermont's are not subject to
concurrency cover. Right. So they're creating trips on the system.
Right.
And they're not paying their fair share.
Well,
that's one perspective.
I agree with my colleagues here. That's one perspective. But I think also that our local city partners are expressing concern with this because, in essence, just like you were talking about impacts, you know, these are. Typically, you will encourage this type of operation to be in the urban area or in the commercial districts. So that's the concern that is present to me. And you may hear from the cities that are saying that they will oppose this. So in terms of impact, according to the current policy and code, are not subject to concurrency, so they are indeed collecting trips. But you open this wide open.
This is just one of the most small sliver of concerns. I mean, we've got sewer versus septic issues. Mm-hmm. We've got health code issues. You're talking ADA issues.
It kind of comes down to the purpose of the residential zone. Home occupation is supposed to be accessory to the primary use. Now we're creating a primary use in a residential area that's commercial. That's fundamentally the issue. I mean, what is accessory? That is fundamentally the question of the day. You know, I mean, and 100% commercial activity is not accessory.
So you know, I can tell you as the author of this ordinance, back in 2004, 2005, we had a task force. You remember rural enterprises? Having sat through 19 meetings over a 9-month process with a facilitator to try to come up with this, I can tell you that we looked at every I and T to make sure we came across. It was a negotiation process. I'd be the first to tell you that the numbers are arbitrary. And everybody knows that. Why is 6 better than 7 or better than 5 or less than 10? It was a negotiated settlement, and I think there was enough realization once the neighbors got to hear from the business owners and the business owners got to hear from the neighbors that there had to be some, but everybody agreed there's practical limits.
Compromise.
These have essentially haven't changed since that period of time. It was a huge process. I'm here to tell you, I was the staff that went through this. And it was, what we had before was, if you looked at the home op, we changed the home business, the home operators came before, it was kind of a joke. Because basically, at that point, you couldn't do anything outside of your house. And everybody said, everybody looked at the proposal, and this is what, which is what you're looking at, and said, well, that's too restrictive. Well, we said, well, have you seen what you're required to do, what's on the books today? So I mean, we opened it up a lot, and there's a reason for that. Because I think it was the 2000 census, I don't have the latest, but the 2000 census, there were 7,000 business owners in the county that listed their home addresses and their business address. So we know how important home businesses are in the county and creating jobs for people who want to start small and hopefully get big enough, like Eric said, so that you move to a commercial storefront. That's the whole idea. Start in your garage, expand it, and then go someplace else where it's, you know, when you need the space, you've got the parking, you do all those, it's expensive, you know how the cost of development. So that's just a little history of how we got to where we are today. Now, are the limits fair? Are they too restrictive? I don't know. But I can tell you, we spent 9 minutes coming up with pretty much everything you see in front of you in terms of home business.
So again, why do we want to, what's behind like lifting the limits?
There's been comments, what I've heard, comments to the counselors, commissioners, that it's too restrictive.
Legit, huge amount of comments. I was curious, like a huge amount of comments? Or
I was kind of new here, so I dealt with a couple specifically. But and again, the only request was for, hey, we're thinking of buying this property. If this was a little bit less restrictive, it would work for us. You know, if it was six employees instead of four, in one case that comes to mind, because when I haven't heard the number, but you know, I want to confess that, you know, we put forward the suggestion of eliminating it, thinking the other things would limit, self-limit the number of employees, but this board would recommend a fixed number of employees, which is higher than they're more comfortable with. I think that would be just as acceptable.
That, I think you can imagine if you had no employees on, say, you were 5 acres on a private road, and all of a sudden you got the person that's at the dead end, you open the business with 50 employees, your quality of life in the rural area is going to change.
That's
what concerns us in terms of looking at what people moved into the rural area for. Some business, yes. Some old business, yes. But how much?
Road maintenance agreements, private road maintenance agreements, and you know, you have, let's just say, four lots out there on a common agreement, and they're buzzing around, and you know, you got six employees driving the road every day, and then you know, neighbor X goes over to neighbor Y and say, hey, they're using the road more, and then it ends up in litigation, or somebody gets shot. Without having limitations, it just seems to be not reasonable.
I'm just going to ask then, what do you expect as a response?
I guess my only concern is, or request would be, in evaluating scenarios, compare it to what they can do now, not versus what they could do if there wasn't a home occupation ordinance. Because right now, your neighbor on 5 acres on a private road can have four employees and six or eight customers come visit a day too. So compared to that, and the requirements he has to go through now, you know, you're right, the private road, we require that to be considered in the permit process now. They have to have an agreement with the neighbors, either practically, or maybe Marty can deal with the details on that. But there's a lot of things with the major home businesses, such as screening the activity from all your neighbors, to having a delineated activity area, designated building space for your business. Those are all in the ordinance now. So the only question really before you is, should we adjust the numbers?
And based on what Gordy just told us, while it might be arbitrary, it was negotiated. I don't think the conditions have changed significantly enough to warrant changing it by any amount, let alone doing away with the number of employees altogether.
So I was asking how many. I was curious how. Some people are always going to want to be pushing up those limits, but if we push those limits up, probably a certain multiplier of the number of calls are going to be from the neighbors that are now looking out at 10 cars rather than four. There's a big difference in the impact. And I was involved in that.
I know you were.
It was arbitrary, but it was kind of like, I mean, everyone could live with it. You know, I lived neighbor's an author who's got four employees.
And it wasn't
four cars don't bother me, but 10, 12 cars.
You know, everybody's got four cars, two cars on a private road in the background. You would notice it.
Yeah.
And that's, we still can do that.
And so it was greatly discussed. Those numbers were, you know, they're always arbitrary when it comes down to that. But they were.
They are. Like I said, I'll be the first to admit that those numbers were upset.
If we push them up now, they'll just be someone going to come and make calls and say, I need just a couple more.
There. Chairman. I think the struggle for me, certainly we're all, I think, sympathetic towards growth and jobs. We all want that. What I'm struggling with, Peter, is what will the impacts be? Just as you described, I don't know what's required with in a comparative analysis right now. I do struggle with going from 4 or 6 to 10. But maybe the other conditions are such that is not really an issue. I don't know, but because I don't have the data in front of me to do a comparative analysis. But based on what I've seen, though, Peter, I'm really struggling to see how this doesn't affect the quality of the neighboring parcels and the neighbors that we all want to protect. I think it could have significant impacts absent some further information.
Yeah, I think the idea that the home business is in the regulations for home business are much less stringent than putting the same business on a commercial or industrial parcel. You have the same parking requirements, you have the same building size things. The idea of this is to make it really simple for a very small business to function as an accessory to get started, but it has to be pretty small. So if you put a limit on that, I think it's going to be easier to open a new business on a residential rural lot than it is in an urban area in a commercial zone. That you've thought about. I mean, these guys did a lot of planning on that. I mean, trying to figure out where's appropriate for commercial, industrial, there's buffering, there's all these like things that go into it. They just kind of put a lot of work into it. So it's arbitrary looking that. Can cause some adverse impacts. So you just keep it through. So I think the intentions are good. I'm all for it. Pro jobs, pro business, I think this board is too. So if you look at the comments we would have versus some of the general public, I think we're pro growth. We've been, you know, accused of being too pro growth. So for us to have concerns, I think doesn't mean a lot. So, or should.
So we've got to find a way to. I'm running the first meeting that was 30 minutes ahead. It's going to be 30 minutes behind schedule. Setting new records. So I don't know if we are.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion. I'd like to make a motion that the board oppose the proposed code changes to lift the restriction, the limit of employees that can be in a major home business. Second.
For a motion and a second.
Any discussion?
Do we want to discuss any?
Do we want to submit some justification?
That's what I was going to add.
And the reason why I haven't added any justification was I think the record of our discussion might be that, just that. Peter can go back and maybe talk to the. Do we need to have a list of reasoning behind our motion?
I think it would be important to summarize it because you can, when you're, I think we need to summarize our conversation right now.
Possibly. I would agree with Eric, and I'd like what Don said in the sense that this becomes more of a primary use now almost than an accessory use. I think there's I think that's meaningful. Our concerns are meaningful, and I think in a paragraph we could provide some insight and background of why we came to this conclusion.
I'm a little concerned in that I'm not that familiar, honestly, with what the code says. You know, Peter's reiterated that there are a lot of limitations built into the code already. But I'm absolutely concerned about it, even without having that familiarity. I think I'm hurt.
Rosie, do you have enough in the record to be able to augment the motion with the reasonings that we've been discussing?
I did not write down a lot, so I have a recorder.
We got the recording.
Could you put that together and maybe circulate that so that we can have a formal response back to the board with regards to our response, so we don't have to kind of, because we're simply running out of time today to go through all things. Is that amenable to the board?
So you want us to write a memo out and everybody
send out
summary?
Summary. There are 3 bullet points right now, though.
Okay.
Yeah. Number one for me, unintended consequences. That's wide open. I don't know what bullet point number 2 is, but for me, that's bullet point number 1.
Primary accessory.
Yeah, I think the intent of residential, whether it's rural or urban, is that residential should always be the primary use of that lot, and home businesses should be accessory, and there's a proportional aspect to that that should not be, you know, shifted towards that being primary. And I think that home occupation struggles with that piece, but I think it's essentially in a nutshell, it's the keeping the nature of residential uses, the purpose of that. Primarily residential, allowing activities that are business oriented, but they're accessory. They should feel accessory.
That is
kind of what Aaron was saying.
Yeah.
Yes. Unintended consequences could open it up for abuse. That's those unintended consequences. Yeah. Did you guys have any
I kind of have by nature home occupation restrictions are much less stringent than the comparable regulations and requirements on a commercial or industrial zone. So if you're going to have the same number of employees, it needs to be more stringent.
And I think that the fourth point is the county is going to end up spending thousands of dollars in code enforcement. I agree. I mean, that's going to be like
the Wild West.
Wild West. The Freedom Zone.
Freedom. Yeah. We just talked real quick. The rural centers were kind of brought up for some of this for the rural area for business. The rural centers were
right down there.
A place for the rural businesses to go. Perhaps. Is that kind of the intent of those? I don't know. Yeah, something
we
want to put in there.
That was, together
but I do think some of this is right from the rural area. If I understand it correctly.
We hope the rural commercial will look at rural center. But this is, like Don said, this is rural property. This is
right.
We want to be able, everybody has the opportunity to start a business on their land.
Right.
Sure. And that was the point of it. And we just put that, again, what you see in front of you is what was negotiated. This has been more than 10 years.
So Rosie, real quick, I think what we could say, so we've identified a few major points, and maybe you can supplement that we have other concerns. We're just homing in on a few of those points.
Right.
Supplement
we
that
have
as a summary of what concerns. I think at this point we've kind of discussed this. Jeff just left. I have a feeling. Where this goes.
He gave me his proxy.
Did he? Okay. don't hold me to Robert's rules of order and whether it's proper or not, but. We do have a motion and a second. I think we're ready to vote on that. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Any abstention?
Thank you, Peter. Thanks, yeah. Thanks for your work on that.
So another fun challenge. The remaining item we have on our agenda for today was to talk some about the work plan for this year moving forward. We're up against a pretty tight timeline.
That's fine. I think I can go through this fairly quickly.
I know you stayed up late working on this, so we're giving you a couple minutes to follow you up.
Essentially, what you have to see in front of you is an amended. You've seen this document before. I'm not exactly sure who originally put this together, but it shows. We're going to need to report to the board here hopefully sooner than last year, which is in June, I believe, to let them know what we've worked on. Some of these items in here will be duplicative of what we've already talked about. Some of them are ongoing. Some of them never leave the list. Second page will you'll see what we've talked about, what we've reviewed, what we have supported throughout 2014. As you work through to page 4, and it says page 404, and then you have page 504. Not exactly sure how that works, but. The work plan suggestions are on page 404. Top three are those items that have been on our work plan as long as I've been on the board here for the last 4 or 5 years. If you go down to the long list down below, that's pretty much what we have looked at as far as maintaining or keeping on our work list going forward. Near the, if you pass the bylaws, and there's the chart that's in the back, and I don't know how much this chart has been used, but I did update it as much as I could by memory. There are several items on here that deed to decide next steps, deed to decide next steps, that may or may not be germane to what we're going to actually be reviewing this year. But I think that the list on page 4 is more of a comprehensive list of what we could potentially look at going forward.
And again, this is after a review of what we reviewed for this last year. A lot of this is going to be ongoing work that we're going to be getting updates on from staff. The final site plan process, while we've reviewed that, and I don't know if staff has implemented any policy changes with regards to that, we do know that they're going to take a look at changes to conditions of approval when those are required to be satisfied. The final plat process is an ongoing process where you kind of see where it comes into practice and adjust it accordingly, but then hopefully make it, if not a quantified process that everybody's going to understand. What I'm going to be looking for, what I hope anybody else has, is anything else we want to discuss. And I'm talking about staff questions at the party, but either from staff or from the board to add to this. Some of it is pretty detailed, some of it is more nebulous. For instance, staffing levels, we're hiring, we got jobs coming out of our ears, and hopefully, staff will be able to maintain that level of that increase in development activity. Some of the things on here and in the chart in the back are things that we've talked about but never really done anything about. I don't know how important they are to keep on the list. So instead of a long discussion today, I know that we're short of time, what I might ask of the board is to review this, to provide me either by email, telephone call, but by before the next meeting, any updates to this so we can solidify this. I'd also like to get staff's input on this, Greg's been copied on this. I know he's out now, but I don't know about any biannual code amendments that are coming up, Marty, except for the two that we just discussed ad nauseum. So if that's going to be something that will be coming up in the spring.
So the biannual code amendments, we usually generate a list that, the list comes from you and from staff and from applicants coming in the door. Jan is usually the one who compiles the list. I don't know of an outcry of amendments, and he's busy doing project review. The two code amendments we talked about are not typical binding code amendments because they're really substantive and policy.
Right.
It's not, house cleaning or housekeeping or reference, errors. So they don't; those aren't typically falling along the lines of a typical binding code amendment. I can ask Jan if he's seen anything, heard anything. We probably want to get going on them sooner than later. Come summertime, things are crazy busy.
Yeah.
More than normal crazy busy. So
I'd be interested in anything. If there has been any discussion about it, anything needs to be changed. Heaven forbid the car cabin code is now so good that the authentication associated with it.
Eric and I had a discussion earlier about some little kind of wrinkle in our archaeological, when we time archaeological review and fully complete and review. So there are some little things out there I know.
Okay.
For my work and a good deal of my department's work starting the end of this month is replacing Tidemark. I am concerned, or I will have at the forefront of my mind the idea of balancing the work to implement that system and managing the workload coming in the door. I have budget authority for backfill staff, and we've already identified those needs. We will have in greater detail when things are going to be happening, when we need to pull somebody out of the building inspection or the permit center. We have hired a couple new folks in the permit center, permit techs.
The onboarding process is underway, so you'll see a couple of faces down there. We have to look at building inspection. We have a couple people who are out for personal and medical reasons. So workload is a constant thing I got to keep kind of keep track of.
Well, I know that the board is supported maintaining development review staff levels instead of focusing on biannual code changes. And if some of these things are things that can be put off, wait, if not, you know, Jan can, you know, pick up these little things here.
Sure. Yeah. We're still open. I mean, I'd still be open to some of these the code amendments that aren't. two or three months long in work sessions.
Right.
I mean, typically our biannual codes, we have one work session, maybe two, and you move them on. Planning Commission, the same thing. So where we can make little minor improvements here and there, and quickly on final plat, Jeff and I have met with other folks, and we do have a common request was we have one person, not two or three.
Yep.
So we have identified one person to take the application of final land division through. It's Angie Merrill. She's really good with some of the detail that you need, attention to detail. She's been in a training mode since December. I think she's coming up to speed really fairly quickly. So that's going well. And I have a meeting scheduled soon, I think next week, where we can look at legal documents that are really boilerplate, that we can look at those for, have them in a PDF format where it's all locked down and you can only, the fillable format is the subdivision name and a couple other things. So if that hits our desk, guess what? You don't need Chris Horn to look at it. Okay? So I know that's been we've identified that as a bottleneck, and where we have projects that are coming through and we're using template covenants and easements and those kinds of things, then hey, you don't even need legal review.
Awesome.
And we don't even need staff to say, hey Chris, can you look at this? We can just by the very nature of the document coming in, we can bypass that. Now if you're making wholesale changes and it's essentially a new document, Chris or somebody from his office will be looking at something. So I think that'll be moving forward. I have a meeting with Chris and Chuck and Dan and that and a couple others, so try to figure out what those documents are and get them in a format that minimizes the need for the prosecutor's review.
So I agree, Mike. I think you're right. You've laid out kind of a good framework. If everybody can look at that work plan, think a little bit about if you've got topics that are relevant to our votes or if they're new or whatever, let's look at whether there's stuff to add to that list. Probably maybe be good to just talk another 10 minutes next month about it.
Sure.
Try to get it finalized and then...
We'll get it. And then the next step, I think, would be to get the meeting scheduled to the board and get this submitted to the board.
Do we want to prioritize these items here?
I think that's something that we've done in the past, but not formally.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking I'm going to respond back, and I'm going to put my...
You did that last year.
That would be helpful, yeah.
Eric did that last year. But I think that's great, because then if the board does ask, so what are your top priorities this year to review, we have something for them, and instead of just saying, well, they all have equal weight.
Thank you for your work.
We've outlived the public, so we won't have any public comment. Does anybody know if the gentleman from AKS was here for
Is that no, he usually comes in and just listens. As far as I know.
It's fine. I may call him on.
Oh.
and see if there's...
Or maybe not at this meeting, but I've seen him in other meetings.
Did he apply for one of the positions?
He may be
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all. This was a good, lively conversation. Kept everyone from falling asleep. So, I guess we'll adjourn until next month. Thank you.